much for inviting me to this wonderful program and also for giving me the possibility to add another talk to today's schedule. As you can see here, I will talk about scattering, but only at low energy, so on Manikov balls with cylindrical ends. This is going to be a blackboard talk, but I wanted to entertain you a little bit in the beginning and show you some movies. And that's not only entertainment, it's also the motivation for what I'm going to look at. So first, it's kind of very, very light motivation, of course. I think needless to say that a lot of physical processes are described by the Schrödinger equation or by the wave equation, but let's not forget that even quantum physics is in the relativistic context, is there a pointer somewhere? Yeah. In the relativistic context is also described by a wave equation, and so the most general setting we can look at, if we look at relativistic quantum theory or wave propagation phenomenon, is our equations of this form here, where we have H is an operator of Laplace type, so it just means that it's going to be some connection Laplacian, or let's say the Laplace-Beltrami operator, plus a potential, plus possibly a magnetic field, and then we are interested in evolution's equation of this form for the moment. Okay, so I'm interested in the relativistic setting. Of course, all I'm going to say also carries over to the non-relativistic setting, but just pictures will be nicer because here you don't have dispersion and you have finite propagation speed. Okay, so a lot of processes are described, so sound in anisotropic media and so on, but also maybe in gravitational backgrounds, as long as the metric is ultrastatic, and you deal with non-trivial metrics. And I said before already that, what did I say before? Yeah, that relativistic quantum field theory and quantum theory are also interesting in this context. Okay, so but I'm not only looking at inverse problems in the way we had them before, but I'm looking at them from a scattering point of view. So that, what does it mean, scattering point of view? That means that I have a comparison operator, and I'm comparing the dynamics in a free case, which doesn't have to be Rn, it can be any model case, and I'm perturbing the model case, and then I'm comparing the two time evolutions, the free time evolution and the perturbed time evolution, and the comparison of this is called scattering theory. There is a dynamical scattering theory and there is a stationary scattering theory. They basically are equivalent if one knows how to translate things. But instead of writing down the usual 30 pages of introduction into scattering theory, I just want to show you a picture. The picture, well, you don't see it yet, but as soon as I switch it on, there is a wave going on, so I don't want to switch it on yet. So it just shows you a half line, and there is a wave coming in, and then there is a potential, and the wave is going to be, the wave is going to be reflected, of course, at the barrier, but then I'm comparing the time evolution with and without potential. Okay, and I did some numerics. So it looks like this. So you have the incoming wave, see, they are more or less the same. Then you have the potential, the wave is reflected. So what can you notice here is that there is a time delay. Yeah? So the shape, I'll show you again. The shape of the wave is almost unchanged, but there is a time delay due to the presence of a potential. Again, so they are in phase, yeah? And then the wave is reflected, and you can see that there is a small shift. Yeah? They reflect the wave with potential was a little bit slower. And that's actually a very interesting phenomenon. So the operator that describes this is the so-called time delay operator in scattering theory. And at zero energy, this is also sometimes called the scattering length. So it's kind of the effective length the potential has. So it's somehow, what piece do I have to add here to take account of the potential so that I can actually take away the potential and to first order, it looks like there is still a potential there. Okay, so the scattering length is some concrete object. You can actually look it up on Wikipedia for neutrons and protons. There are scattering length tables and things like that. So that the what that was the one-dimensional situation. Let's have a look at the two-dimensional situation. The situation with two ends. That's what I wanted to say. Okay, here the same phenomenon. What have I showed you here? That's not a potential perturbation. That's a perturbation of the metric in one dimension. Okay, so this here is optically more dense. So this is still a smooth cutoff function, and I'll show you that again. The speed here is lower in here, so it's optically more dense. So the metric is larger, whatever that means. Yeah? And there are two phenomena here. Yeah? So you can see that it's lower, right? It slows down. There are again two phenomena which dominate this process. So there is one which is called the reflection and transmission. So that's the scattering matrix itself. And there is again the time delay, which shows you that there is a significant delay between the reflected and wave with the transmitted wave with and without this perturbation. Okay, what happens if we are optically less dense? Then this looks like this. Okay, so it speeds up and then it overtakes the other wave. So it looks all very nice. So there are several questions one can ask here. For example, there was a lot of speculation in the physics literature, and there was a lot of quarrel actually in the physics literature, because what turns out that if you don't change the metric and you add a potential, it could still happen that the time delay is negative. And that, of course, superluminal propagation of signals and so on, yeah? So that could still happen. And of course, this is not right, because finite propagation speed still holds, right? But nevertheless, so the scattering, so it's really an interpretation of how you interpret the scattering length, which is a quadratic form on the absolutely continuous spectrum of the operator. Okay, interesting things going on here. I think the main question is how did I make these movies, yeah? I think that's also a mathematical question, because it took me half an hour to produce such a movie. And I'll show you how this is done, because it's really enormously easy to make such a movie here. Because all you need to do is you need to solve the stationary Schrödinger equation, and you do it, of course, numerically in Mathematica, and then you get a family of generalized eigenfunctions, and you just form a wave packet out of there, a Gaussian wave packet out of these generalized eigenfunctions, and there you go, right? You plug these into Mathematica and plot the movie. So it's very, very easy. But on the side, you also learn something. Of course, what is always true is that these generalized eigenfunctions will always exist. They will have this form here, okay? So they will have an incoming part, and there will be an outgoing part, which is multiplied by the scattering matrix at energy lambda. Of course, that's completely clear. What's the Jost solution? I'm not using physics notation. So here I'm using my own notation, which is, of course, superior to the physics notation. Let me show you how this works. Phi here is a function which is locally constant at infinity. So that means phi could be either 1 on the left-hand side and 0 on the right-hand side, or the other way around. Okay? And what I do is I'm interpreting phi as an incoming wave. And you're absolutely right, actually. You criticized me because I'm missing here a modulus of x. That's right. Yeah. Modulus of x. Oh no. Yeah. Sorry, I've missed that point. Yeah. Okay. That's very important. So for me, what is here is always incoming. It's incoming from the left. And it's also incoming from the right. And that's always going to be the outgoing part. Okay. And the advantage over this kind of notation is, so there is a disadvantage, and the disadvantage is that the reflection coefficients will be the coefficients on the diagonal. And the transmission coefficients will be off diagonal. But there is also an obvious advantage, because it clearly carries over. It doesn't matter if it's R or R with three ends, or a quantum graph with I don't know how many ends attached to it, or only one end like we had before. It's always the same formulation. And the scattering matrix is going to be, well, an n times n matrix if I have half lines which are attached, yeah, to it. So that's a very good way of formulating it. And it's also going to be the notation I'm using for the cylindrical ends. And then there is, of course, a very easy to prove theorem here in this context, namely the whole scattering theory. You can choose the existence of these generalized eigenfunctions. So again, there is a modulus of x here. they depend meromorphically on the parameter lambda, so that's a theorem. They can be chosen to depend meromorphically on lambda, so they always satisfy this equation here. And this fact that they depend, the existence and the fact that they meromorphically depend on lambda is completely independent of whatever you do in a compact region. So either you plug in a quantum graph or you do add a potential or you change the metric in a compact region, this always gives you, this is always true. Okay, so this meromorphic continuation of the resolvent is always true. And I think I will show you how that works in this, because it's a very, very simple argument. But I think this is planned for later. So I'll show you that later, how that works. Okay, so I said that already, that it's a little bit different from the physics notation. And what I will talk about now, and I think slowly I'm switching over to the board, is the situation when you have a manifold with a cylindrical end or a waveguide with Neumann boundary conditions at an end. So you have, it's essentially a one-dimensional situation if the energy is low. So you have a manifold with a base y. Then there is a wave coming in, it's being scattered by the manifold, and then it's being reflected. And you want to know what will happen in this situation. And I think for the case of functions, this was already looked at by people in the audience. Recently, for example, it's known that the isometry class of the metric on M is completely determined if you know the scattering matrix at all energies. Okay, so how does that look like? So that took me much longer to produce this movie because of complicated graphics options in Mathematica. But you can see blue is less dense optically, yeah, and red is more dense. And if you look very, very carefully, then you can see that still there is reflection and transmission taking place. So here it's more dense, yeah, it slows down, and then there is a small reflected wave. So that's the situation already. So this is just a metric perturbation, but already there is non-trivial things going on. And in fact, this is the example which you see when you look out of the window. Let me explain you why. So if you look out of the window, there will be part of the wave, I mean, is reflected at the window and part goes through. So if you look at the window like that, then you have a short region where there is a metric change going on. You have a refraction index on one side and you have a refraction index on the other side. But then also, I mean, because we know that glass is kind of translation invariant, or at least has a discrete symmetry group in two directions, you can factor that out. Okay, so there is a translation symmetry in this direction, and there is a translation symmetry in that direction. So if you factor that out, what you actually get is a two torus. Yeah, here. And another two torus here. And then this two torus has volume N1. And these two torus has volume N2. Yeah? So you can think of it like this, actually. So when you look out of the window, you're exactly in this situation, except that this is not going to be a sphere, but a torus. And in physics, we have the Fresnel formulas, which tell us that the reflection coefficient, it's N2 minus N1 divided by N2 plus N1. And the transmission coefficient is 2N2 divided by N1 plus N2. So that's what we know from physics. And if you look at Wikipedia, Fresnel formula, there is yet another movie which I can show. So here is the incoming wave. It goes to the window, and then part of it is reflected and part of it is transmitted. The Fresnel formulas describe that. And what I want to give, so part of today's entertainment is I will want to give you a cohomological proof of this formula. So that's somehow which something still known. And what I want to give you then is I want to discuss the time delay, the scattering length for these manifolds of cylindrical end, and I want to give you a geometric cohomological interpretation of the scattering length. Okay? So that's what I want to do. And this was a joint work with Werner Müller. I should say that before I continue and forget it. Where we look at this case for, and I don't want to restrict myself to functions. I want to consider p-forms. simply because, well, if you look out of the window, you're actually scattering one forms and not scalars, because light, it's a one form, so light has a polarization, and this one, you want to take this into account. No, light is a one form. I will write this down later anyway. I will explain it. Right. So yeah, I mean you are right, but in four dimensions it's the one form, and then you have you decompose into components. Yeah, that's right. But I mean, okay. So you are right. Of course, there are two fields, but light is, so there is a potential and there is a vector potential. So, and if you have wave propagation, you can always gauge away the component. So then the A field. So then I think no, that's, there is only one form. So the A field in three dimensions. No, in three dimensions. No, if you look only at wave propagation, yes. No, then you have the, but you have, I'm looking at A, not E and B. No, you mean something else. I will explain you now, okay? So the light propagation, that's A of X and T, so that's the one form, right? On R3. So for a fixed time slice. And there is a gauge condition which says this one form should be closed. Okay? And then you can apply the D operator. Yeah, okay, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it's two one forms which are coupled. No, it should be all right. No, it's right. No, sorry. Because the B field is then the time derivative of the E field, so they are coupled. No, I mean, wave. No, I remember from my second year in physics that, yeah, fine, but nevertheless, so the wave can be described by the A alone, right?
No.
Why not?
Well, you need
to go to the second order. No. It's just like putting Maxwell's equations in. Yeah, maybe Maxwell's equations in. Yeah, maybe you can use the Fourier equation.
Yes, but it's like Maxwell's
using
E and B or E and H.
No, I'm using vector potentials. I'm not using E and B and A and H. A and phi you can gauge away because J is zero. There is no, so I'm looking only at wave propagations in empty space. No J, yeah? Yeah, okay. No, I'm looking at light, so I'm not looking at electrostatic. So you are right. So I think, just to clarify that, yeah? So there is everything can be described by the vector potential and by V, yeah? So I'm putting V equals zero, then I have a co-closed one form, and it means light propagation is described by co-closed one forms which satisfy, in this case, then the wave equation. Yeah. So indeed, what I want to look at is that one form scattering on cylinders over tori, or topological perturbations. And in fact, the way Fresnel's formulas are proved, it's, you know, they always assume that there is a transition, right? There is a discontinuous transition from N1 to N2. But it's not true. There are a lot of atoms. There can be a lot of things going on there. And what I want to show you is that doesn't matter what's going on in there. It's always going to be that formula. So that's the aim of what, not only the aim of the talk, but one of the, sorry, that's not yet the end of the talk. Okay. So I want to switch now to mathematics. Oh, one cannot switch it off. How? Maybe here? Should I just press the switch off button?
No,
ah, okay. End presentation. There you go. There it is. And how do I? Now I have to.
Did you put off here?
Okay. Fantastic. I think it's off. And then, but then I want to lift the.
I don't know what you pressed, but this is the, is this off?
I pressed end presentation. But does that move the screen? Okay, so we can switch it on again. Oh. Oh. Okay, so let me just explain you a little bit what is known, what's fairly easy to prove. So we have this situation here, a manifold with cylindrical ends, and of course I don't assume that the end has one component. So, for example, it could look like this, or maybe even one more end. Okay. So what I have is, just to fix notations, so I'll cut this off here. So there is a boundary which consists of, which can be a disconnected. So Y would be the disjoint sum of the disjoint union of boundary components. And then I have an interior here, M. And then I have a big manifold which is non-compact, which I call X. So what X is then, I take the manifold M, that's a manifold with boundary Y. And then, can you all read that here? Yeah. And then I glue along Y the cylinder over Y, so R plus cross Y. So when I glue these together, I get the non-compact manifold X, and I'm assuming that on this part here, the metric is of product type. So if I take the metric on X, and I restrict it to the cylinder, and I want to call the cylinder Z, so this is Z here. So Z for cylinder. And so that has the form du squared plus h, so where h is a metric on y, so h is a metric on y, and u is the, let's call it radial coordinate, okay, the radial coordinate. Okay, so then we look at the Laplace operator P. So the Laplace operator on P forms. So that's defined by d delta plus delta d. So of course that's just the usual Laplace-Beltrami operator here. Then normally for the Maxwell equations I would have this part only. Right, but I'm assuming that I have co-closed forms, so that this part goes away anyway. And I'm so if I want to look at a spectral theory of this operator, so this operator acts on functions, on compactly supported smooth functions with values in the p-form bundle. So, and there it is essentially self-adjoint by the usual Cherenkov argument that X is complete, so this is an essentially self-adjoint operator. But I want to restrict myself to the kernel of delta. So that's, in physics, is called a gauge condition. There is absolutely no restriction if I do that, because this is an invariant subspace, and I apply the Hochstar operator, I get to the orthogonal complement. So there is a Hodge decomposition. Right. Even for the non-compact part, there is a Hodge decomposition. So I have harmonic plus kernel D plus kernel delta. So there are two arguments for restricting myself to kernel delta. First of all, it's not really a restriction, and the second is that's what you have to do in physics anyway, and you just get into a notational mess if you don't do it. Okay. So how does the spectrum look like? So the spectrum of the operator looks like that. So right. Yeah. Like this? Maybe I just move to the other board. It's a bit better. So how does the spectrum look like? Spectrum looks like this. So I have mu 0, mu 1, mu 2. So mu I are the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator on p-forms on the boundary. Some of them co-closed, some of them not, yeah? So that now I'm getting a little bit into trouble here. And it's actually part of the spectrum of the Laplace of this operator here. So, and there is, with every this eigenvalue, there is another branch of continuous spectrum appearing here. Okay? And that's basically just a consequence of a simple consequence of a scattering theory argument, because that's how the spectrum looks like on every end, because you do a separation of variables, and then you just apply the standard machinery. So you glue resolvents, and then the immediate consequence is the spectrum in the perturbed case looks, the continuous spectrum in the perturbed case looks exactly the same. And I'm, for this talk now, for the moment, I'm going to phrase, I'm only interested in this here. So let's say there are harmonic forms on the boundary. So then this will be zero here. The first eigenvalue will be zero. Yeah, one of those. So for example, for functions, this is always true because the constant function on the boundary is a zero eigenvalue. And no, so not one of those. Here, it's really the whole spectrum of the P formula. All of them, yeah. And you will see why in a second. You can put whatever boundary condition you want at the using scattering theory.
No, I mean you have zero to be eigenvalue.
What do you mean by Dirichlet boundary conditions? Oh, if it's a waveguide, you have to have Neumann boundary conditions for what I will say. Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay, so I will be interested in this disk here. So I will be interested only in modes which are constant in this direction here. So, and if the energy is low enough, there are only these modes. So for low energy, there will be no excitations in this direction. So it means that in this direction, the form will be harmonic. And in this direction, you have an incoming wave. So let's put a theorem there. It's proved in our paper, but it's kind of the general well-known stuff, which I think is also proved in a lot of other papers. For example, I think it's proved in your papers or in a lot of papers by Melrose and in the book of Melrose. I want to phrase it in a certain way. Do you treat the P-form case? No. Ah, okay, so maybe it's not in your book then. So for each... So if I fix a harmonic form on the boundary, so a harmonic form on the harmonic p-form on the boundary, so that's the kernel of the p-form Laplace operator on the boundary. So for functions, this just means that I'm looking at a locally constant function on the boundary. So again, if I have two count boundaries, that will be a two-dimensional space. If I have three boundaries, it will be a three-dimensional space, and so on. So it's exactly like before. But for forms, it will be more complicated because cohomology appears. Yeah? So there exist unique meromorphic functions now. The first meromorphic function is so meromorphic in lambda. So in lambda, yeah, functions f psi comma lambda, so that will be a p form on x, and another function, so which is called the scattering matrix, and which I denote by s of lambda, such that the following is true. So first, F is co-closed. So for functions, this is not a condition. And second, it's a generalized eigenvalue. So F eigenfunction F psi comma lambda is equal to zero. And as you can see, that I'm just to annoy you, I was using the geometric Laplacian, which is positive. Yeah, so d delta plus delta d. And three, actually, so we can see it's not yet unique. Yeah? So there exists a function R, p comma lambda, on which is an L2 function on the cylinder only, so a p-form on the cylinder, such that f on the cylinder has a special form. If you restrict it to the cylinder, then it will be of the form e to the minus I lambda u. times psi. So this makes sense. Yeah? If psi is a form on the boundary, then you can multiply, you get a p form on the cylinder. So plus e to the plus I lambda u s of lambda times p, and plus the term which is in L2, so which is, in this fact, it's not only in L2, it's even exponentially fast, it's decreasing, psi comma lambda. Okay, so that's the theorem, and that makes it unique. So why is it unique? Because if you have two, right, it's a meromorphic family, so it would have to, so you take the difference between two, it will be in L2 on the cylinder, therefore it would be in L2 everywhere, right, because by elliptic regularity it will be smooth anyway. So if you, you have two such families, they, because they operate as self-adjoint, it doesn't have an L2 solution in the upper half plane, but the family is meromorphic, so it have to vanish everywhere, okay? So that's unique. So for example, that's why this really is the continuous spectral subspace. There is no discrete spectrum in this thing because it has to be orthogonal to the L2 spectrum. Sorry? No, lambda is in that ball over there. So for all lambda in that ball around zero of radius mu 1. And I think square root actually. Yeah, so lambda squared is the eigenvalue. So that's the situation, right? So near zero, this whole thing is very, very easy. And you see there is no mixture. Co-closed in this near zero just means that there are no no terms of the form du wedge psi. That's what this means, yeah. So it's enormously easy. That's actually a very good way. That's why co-closed really makes everything much, much easier. You see, if you don't have the co-closed condition, what this means is that you have a form on the cylinder will have two components. It will be something which is in fiber direction, and then there will be a du wedge and p minus one form in fiber direction, and you don't really want that, and you can avoid it by just requiring that everything is co-closed. Okay, so now how do you prove it? That's so easy that I want to show you how to do it. Of course, I'm cheating, as always, when things are easy. So idea. So first, construct a meromorphic continuation of the resolvent of the Laplace operator minus lambda squared to the minus one. But of course not as, a, as an operator in L2 because that doesn't work, but as a distributional kernel with values of course then in the box tensor product. So distributional kernel, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. So as in some weighted L2 spaces, this has a meromorphic continuation. How do you construct this? So by gluing plus, what is it called? I forgot the name. No, that's H, huh? No, that's the third. The second is, yeah, thank you very much, yeah? So the meromorphic Fredholm theory. Sorry? The what? No. That Sobolev spaces are compactly embedded on. Thank you. That's what I meant. Yeah. Press release. So there is a very nice trick. Yeah. You let the manifolds overlap, which you glue, and then you use two gluing function in such a way that you connect. It's really a one-page argument. Very beautiful. But so a meromorphic Fredholm just gives you that this is a meromorphic continuation, and then you can just construct the generalized eigenfunction in this way here. So what do you do? You take e to the minus I lambda u, and you multiply that by a cutoff function, which is constant, where is my manifold? Which is constant equal to 1 here, and which is 0 inside, okay? Or maybe let's be safe, let it just make it 0 here, yeah? So there is a smooth function which is one on this, which is one outside a compact set. So and if I do that, I can do this construction here, e to the minus I lambda u. So if I apply the Laplace operator to this, and then I apply the resolvent to this, and I subtract, then I will get a solution to the, then I'll get exactly what I want. Okay? So now always people ask me, why is that not zero? Because this obviously cancels out, yeah? And then, so, yeah. But I think I don't have to explain this. Yeah. So, but I mean, it's clear that it has these properties because that's a meromorphic function. Yeah? Okay, so but now you do a very soft analysis of everything, and you discover very nice things. So now by doing nothing, so very soft things. So theorem and theorem without work, yeah? Almost without work. So you need to apply Green's formulas a little bit. So the scattering matrix turns out to be unitary. I want to have a bar here. S of lambda is equal to the identity. So I should maybe say that this means S of lambda is actually an endomorphism on the space of harmonic P forms now. So what does it mean? That's already cohomology, because harmonic P forms on the boundary, that's just... Yeah, always. So for the whole talk, I will only restrict myself to this. So the scattering matrix acts on the cohomology of the boundary. That's the point. Okay, it's unitary, of course, but it has more interesting properties. For example, it satisfies a functional equation is equal to the identity. So S of minus lambda times S of lambda is equal to the identity. But more interestingly, it anti-commutes with the Hochstar operator. Okay. So that's quite funny, but it's very easy. You know, you just apply star and use uniqueness. That's all you do here. Okay, so it anti-commutes with the Hochstar operator, and that's quite funny because it has an immediate strange consequence. Let's think for a moment. So I want to write down a corollary of that. Do I have? That's all. I don't have more boards. Okay, three here. Yeah. Ah. Yeah, but I don't want, no, I should have, one always has to start with the middle board, I think, that's the rule. I can continue here. So corollary, signature of X, signature of Y is zero. So that proves that CP2 cannot be a boundary. So in other words, the signature is a cobordism invariant. It just follows from scattering theory as an easy corollary. So that, by the way, I just say this to, of course, this is well known before, and there are also easy proofs using cohomology theory, but it just shows you that there is something non-trivial going on in this, even already in this relation. So why is that? Because the scattering matrix, at zero, it's a self-adjoint operator. It squares to 1, so that it has plus and minus 1 eigenspaces, and the star operator intertwines those. Or in other words, the scattering matrix intertwines the plus and minus 1 eigenspaces for the Hochstar operator, but so it means the plus and minus 1 eigenspaces for the Hochstar operator have the same dimension. It means that the signature is 0. So very easy. Okay, so that was the corollary, but now I want to get into a little bit of substance here, if I can find my notes. So another corollary, S of zero decomposes HP of Y into plus and one minus one eigenspaces. Okay, so this basically follows a classical paper of Atiya Patodi and Singer now in the analysis, and I think so everything is still well known, yeah. So didn't maybe say that. Still known, but nevertheless no were written. So another like theorem, but well known in the book of Ellen Rose, maybe one can find it, is that the plus one eigenspace of S0 is exactly the image of HP of M in HP of Y. Okay, so there is an exact sequence in cohomology, and the image of the cohomology of the boundary is exactly the plus one eigenspace of S, and the minus one eigenspace is then just the orthogonal complement, of course. Yeah. So what does it mean? That the scattering matrix at zero is completely determined by cohomology. Okay, what's the example for functions? Maybe some of you don't like cohomology, I don't know. So what's the cohomology of for example, for functions? Yeah? So then these are exactly the functions which can be obtained by restricting locally constant functions in the interior to the boundary. So this just means that the plus one eigenspace of the scattering matrix is the constant function 1, and the minus one eigenspace is the orthogonal complement of the constant function 1. Right? So that's what it means. So for in particular, if I'm in the case of a torus like before, I can just compute the scattering matrix at zero. So because... No, I think I'll continue now here. And I think I have to speed up my talk. But I promised you a cohomological proof of the Fresnel formula, so I will probably do that. So what it means for functions, S0, for functions, let's say we are in a case, we have two boundary components, then I can choose the basis, so a basis in H0 of Y, so I can choose the constant function and the orthogonal complement of the constant functions, maybe suitably normalized. So, and in this basis, the scattering matrix takes this form, plus 1, minus 1. Yeah? But that's not a very intuitive basis, because what on earth does that mean? You send in waves from both sides and then something happens. The basis where you can read off the transition and reflection coefficient is another basis. It's the basis where you have 1 on one end and 0 on the other end. Okay, and the other way around. So now what you want to do is you want to transform into the other basis. So now do the computation. So we transform into the other basis. And what you get, so S prime, is volume of Y1. So why is that? Because take the orthogonal complement of 1, it needs to be volume of Y1 on Y2 and minus volume of Y2 on Y1. So what you will get is this, volume of Y1 minus volume of Y2, 2 volume Y2, 2 volume Y1, volume Y1, or volume Y2 maybe minus volume Y1, which is exactly Fresnel's formulas, because that's N1 minus N2, maybe I forgot something, divided by volume, so times 1 over volume Y1 plus volume Y2. Okay? So that's how you get Fresnel's formulas out of that. So it shows you that it proves something, because what it proves is that Fresnel's formulas are valid even in this complicated case when you have a topological perturbation, right? Always valid. And it says even more, because it means that as you let the... So this is just a scaling argument, right? So you let the size of the transition go to zero. This is actually a holomorphic expansion, a full asymptotic expansion which converges, and the first term is the Fresnel term. So it proves even that. And it's not very difficult. Okay, I think I should maybe state our results now, because I don't have much time left. So I said something about the time delay, and there is a formula which we proved in this case of cylindrical ends, and this is the so-called Eisenbud-Wigner formula. Just state what it is. Oh, there is a middle. We proved the Eisenbud-Wigner formula. What's that? That the time delay operator at energy lambda is given by minus I S star of lambda S prime of lambda. So that's the Eisenbud-Wigner formula. We proved it in this context. You can make perfect sense of this. I don't have time now to do this. There is a rigorous way to define the time delay by comparing the time the wave packet spends in the manifold. And you just use dynamical scattering theory to compare these two wave packets which come in from infinity. And then you can actually prove that the corresponding quadratic form gives you a self-adjoint operator. This self-adjoint operator commutes with the free time evolution. Therefore, it has in the spectral decomposition, it acts on every fiber, and then you can prove that it has this form. So that's what we did in the appendix of our paper. It's not very hard. It actually just follows along the same lines as the original proof by Wigner. Eisenbud's paper is not accessible anymore. So it means the scattering length that's going to be t of 0, well, it's just the derivative at 0, so minus I s star, but s of 0 is just s of 0 to the minus 1, with s 0 s prime of 0. And so now the claim is this again has a cohomological interpretation. And for this, I want to write down a huge exact sequence. The usual exact sequence, we have cohomology with compact support on X, then we have this goes into cohomology of X, absolute cohomology, then this goes to cohomology of the boundary. So that's the usual exact sequence in cohomology. Of course, I always mean with values in R. So this gives you a long exact sequence because then you have the connecting homomorphism, which let's call it partial here, which goes into HP plus 1 in relative cohomology. So that's the situation. So this is an exact sequence, so the orthogonal complement of this map here is exactly the plus 1 eigenspace. The orthogonal complement of the kernel of this map is exactly the plus 1 eigenspace, and the kernel of this map, no, the other way around. The kernel of this map is the plus one eigenspace. The orthogonal complement of the kernel of this map is the minus one eigenspace of the scattering matrix. And so now something which is maybe first done by Melrose. So there are, no, but which is already implicit in the paper of Attia and Patodi and Singer, that you can look at the so-called extended harmonic forms. Relative, so this gives you an isomorphism, so you can represent every single class in here by a harmonic form, which is something which decays plus something which is constant. This is HP absolute relative X, and this space here decomposes into the space of L2 integrable harmonic forms, so the discrete spectrum at zero. So L2 harmonic forms, plus our generalized eigenfunctions evaluated at zero. Okay, so span of F, I think we called it F, right? Not E, don't remember now. F. comma 0. Okay, so that you can represent this cohomology in this way. So the image of the compact cohomology in here are exactly the L2 harmonic forms. That's what the Tatia Patodi Singer. And the orthogonal complement of the kernel of this map is that. So that's the spectral interpretation of cohomology here. So what's the interpretation of the scattering length? So, and that's exactly this question here. So all these maps are natural, and there are natural inner products here. So what's the natural inner product on the space of these extended harmonic forms? So you do something very, very easy. You cut off at a point A, you integrate, you compute the L2 inner product on a cut-off manifold, and as A goes to infinity, the cutoff parameter goes to infinity, of course this will diverge. But there will be a constant term in the asymptotic expansion, and you define this to be your inner product. Okay? So that was done by Melrose already. So there is a natural inner product here, and I think we also clarified that in our paper, that all these constructions are natural. So this injects here into the partial isometry and so on. Except one thing, that this is not a partial isometry. So the only map which is not a partial isometry, so by the way, the pairings give you the cup products and so on. You know, everything is, these are the best, there is no doubt that these are the best inner products. So these here are actually finite dimensional inner product spaces with a natural inner product. And it's a natural question to ask whether this is a partial isometry, right? And the answer is,
it is.
It is not a partial isometry. So theorem. So that's that T naught is positive invertible, so a positive invertible operator, and uniquely determined by cohomology again. Namely, it's the operator which measures how far away this is from a partial isometry. Up to a factor of 2. And then you also know that it commutes with the Hochstar operator. So in these properties together, then determine the scattering length uniquely. So that gives you a cohomological interpretation. And so let me show you what this means. It means that for one end, you can actually calculate the scattering length. So if y is equal to y1, so that's this case here, if only one end, you can use this relation here. It's very easy just to compute the scattering length. So what gives you T of 0 is 2 times volume of M divided by volume of Y. Natural. What else can it be? If you replace it by a cylinder, then it's exact, because you will go to the end of the cylinder, you will be reflected, and that's exactly 2 times the length of the cylinder, right? Sorry? It's a map from, so the cohomology on functions only, yeah? On functions. On functions, sorry, I didn't say that. Yeah. No, for forms you don't get that. Yeah, for functions, that's the case. For forms, you have to work more. I don't know. I will show you an example. I hope I will show you an example later. No, you don't get something. You cannot compute it, simply. Okay, maybe not everybody is familiar with this connecting homomorphism, so I want to explain what this actually means in terms for functions. So, namely, in the case when Y consists of 2 boundary components, so So you have a situation like this. And then you have a two-dimensional space. And in the same way as before, you have these bases where the scattering matrix has the form 1 minus 1. And in these bases, T for functions, you have, it will be a diagonal. It will be diagonal and of the form T1, T2. And you again know that T1 will be 2 times volume of M divided by volume of Y. But what you don't know is what T2 is. So how do you get T2? Well, you get it from there. Namely, what do you have to compute? You have to solve a hydrodynamic problem. Namely, you take the vector field, which has this form, which ends up here, which goes from here to here, okay? Because that's exactly the image you get from the connecting homomorphism. So it has to be perpendicular to the boundary and constant. It has to be harmonic. And that comes out from the theory here that there exists a unique harmonic vector field. So what you see, this meaning of this exact sequence there is that if you fix the boundary condition constant here, and orthogonal to the boundary, then harmonic determines the vector field completely in this situation. And, if you fix, of course, you have to say it's equal to plus 1 here, and then it will have to be equal something else here. And then you compare the norms. So you compare the norm on the boundary, and the L2 norm of the vector field inside when you make A large enough. And this quotient will give you the scattering length. Exactly. Okay? So this becomes a hydrodynamic problem because this is exactly you pump in some liquid here, yeah, and then it goes out here, and you want to know what the L2 norm of the velocity vector field is, and that gives you the scattering length. And the question is, how can you compute T2? What does it say about the geometry? And it says the following. That's actually one of our main theorems. So how is that an inverse problem? Let's say you have measured the scattering length and you want to know what's the restriction on the geometry. So for example, you measure that a certain length takes 1 second to go through the manifold, speed of light, right? So do you now think that the distance between the boundary components has to be larger than the distance you expect, or is it smaller or something of this kind? Yeah, and this is exactly what we looked at. And so here is the theorem. So the geometric estimates for the scattering length, it's the following. So let's say C and P plus 1, I want, because I don't have time anymore, I will make the formulas easier. So P is either equal 0 or 1. And then we have 1/2 times vol star of M to the minus 1. So vol star of M is equal to the volume of M plus the volume of Y divided by mu 1. That has the right dimension. So that's an effective volume of M. So and what I do is I take the fundamental cycle of M, and then I take the cup product with the boundary of phi, and I take the stable norm, the cap product, not the cup product, the stable norm of that and square it, and then I know that this is smaller equal than phi t to the minus 1, 0, phi smaller equal than 1/2 volume of M times boundary isomorphism, and here I'm using the Comas norm in cohomology, and so this is true for all phi in the minus one eigenspace of S of 0. Okay. And need some explanation, but maybe I will not say the explanation too long. Yeah, so that corresponds exactly to the situation where you have this harmonic vector field. Yeah, and so I think instead of explaining too much what this means, I'll just explain you what it means in this example. It's maybe easier. Just a word, yeah? So this is the stable norm of a homology class. It just means that so a homology class, it's like a surface in the manifold, and you minimize the volume of the surface. That's what you do, then this minimal volume is like this stable norm. The Comas norm is like the L infinity norm in the RAM cohomology. So the RAM forms, you can define something like an L infinity norm for differential forms. And then you have this. And so what we used is an important result in Federer, geometric measure theory, that these two norms are dual to each other. So we can actually use all these to compute things. Okay, so blah, 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 and sounds all very educated. But what this really means is the flow lines of this thing, they have to be longer than the distance between those two boundary components. Okay, that's what it means in this particular situation. So if you look at differential zero forms, then you're going to get something like the distance between the boundary components. But what is quite surprising, if you have one form scattering, then what you should do is you should actually have a two surface connecting the boundary components and minimize its volume. Okay, so it's quite interesting that you actually get some non-trivial soap bubble mathematics into the scattering theory here. Okay, so what I want to do is I just want to explain what this formula does in this situation, and then I think I will just end the talk. So I'll write down what the estimate gives if you carry out all the identifications. So in the case, well, that simple example just tells you that T2, so remember T1 we know, yeah? And now all I need to do is to estimate T2. T2 is smaller equal and greater equal than C2, C1. And C2, C1 is 2 times volt star of M, so perfectly computable, times the volume of Y1, times the volume of Y2, so still everything is fine, times the volume of Y1 union Y2, or in other words, the volume of Y1 plus the volume of Y2, times the class of Y1 injected into the homology on M, and then its stable norm. So what on earth is that? That's the cross section. You see? Because what's the class? So what I'm doing is I'm taking anything that is cohomologous to the boundary, to one boundary component, for example this, and then I'm minimizing its volume. That's, in my opinion, that's just the cross section. Okay, so this is the cross section. So if you know the scattering length, then you will be able to say something about the cross section. And C2 is 2 times volume of M to the minus 1. And here comes the distance between the boundary components, but squared, times volume Y1, times volume Y2, divided by volume of Y1 union Y2. Okay? So that's, I think I'll stop here. I do have another example where you have a full torus and you have one form scattering, so then you can also make everything explicit and the result is always the same. You take some surface in the manifold and then you minimize the volume, and in this way you get estimates for the scattering length in this way. So I